This is the second session of an interview with Ray Beckwith on the 15th of November 2005 for the University of Adelaide Oral History, interviewer Rob Lynn. Ray, just coming back to the progress through the course at Roseworthy, could you tell me a little bit how the course progressed for you, and what subjects you took and your specialties as you went along?
I put an accent on the agriculture and viticulture, dairying in that in the practical field. I liked the veterinary subjects, and that became important later on when I was looking for a job, when I was thinking of what am I going to do.
Yes.
And so I've mentioned the viticulture, enology, the dairying, and the veterinary subjects. And when I finished, it was a toss-up, all right. It was Great Depression. Unemployment was 30%, and no dole.
Mm.
So I thought of going on to university to do a science degree in agriculture. But my father took me to the Waite Institute, and we met Professor A.E.V. Richardson, the director. And he said, Ray, there's too many BSCs driving tram cars. He said, get a job and forget about university. So that's just what I did. Well then, which direction? So this, I didn't want to be a farmer. So there was dairying, but that was in the technical side of dairying, factory work.
Mm-hmm.
Or winemaking, and there was a scholarship going Sydney University for veterinary science. Well, I knocked back the veterinary science because of the depression. A lot of farmers could not afford the veterinary fees, because the veterinary fees were higher than the value of the animals in some cases.
Mm.
And on top of that, 5 years away from home was a bit daunting. And so...
Had you been outside South Australia at this time?
It would have been, yes. There was no veterinary course.
It would have been in Sydney, right?
Yeah, in Sydney. Yes.
Had you been outside of South Australia?
At that time, no.
So it was a very big thing.
Yes, that's right. And so it was the enology that won over. So that's the core. And of course, the subjects that support you with chemistry and physics and botany and bookkeeping, all these sort of things, well, they supported those courses.
Ray, were your parents supportive of your education?
Yes, they were. And there was talk that I should go to Montpellier University in France.
Who suggested that, I wonder?
Well, there's a link up here. My father was in hardware, and he dealt with hazel groves in Goodyear Street.
Mm.
And, of course, the chief, Mr. C.F. Hazelgrove, he took an interest in me. And he was a nice old boy. And when I had my intermediate certificate, I remember he sent me congratulations and a pocket knife. You know, that's that sort of thing. Now, his two sons, Colin and Ron, went to Montpellier. So my father thought, well, if I'm going into the wine business, well, that wouldn't be a bad idea. But that didn't come to fruition. because other things got in the way, and I got married instead. Not that I regret being married, but that that's the sort of thing that happens.
So you marry Coral Lodge?
Yes, that's right.
So who were her parents, Ray, and what did they have to do with Roseworthy?
Well, Coral Lodge went out to Roseworthy to help her sister May Williams, John Williams' wife. So you can see the connection there with them. She was living with John and May Williams, and of course Stan Close, who was another cadet, and I went off and find ourselves down there playing bridge and with a nice supper, and that's how things had progressed.
Now, Ray, it seems you were doomed to the wine industry at every turn. Can you tell me a little bit about the structure of the oenology and viticulture within the course you did?
Yes. The viticulture that consisted of a lot of practical work as well, besides doing the lectures. The college was set up with nice vineyards, low yielding vineyards, and they made their own wine, of course. And the oenology course was optional. It was an optional subject in the Roseworthy Diploma of Agriculture. And I think it was optional because some parents objected to their sons being involved with wine. Oh. It was the time. This is way back. Here we are in 1930 in that area.
Prohibition.
Well, they didn't like the idea of students being associated with alcohol. So that was it. It was a good basic course. John Williams was good in the basic elements of a subject, and he lectured quite well.
And in the wine, so was he doing the winemaking as well as the viticulture?
Yes, he was doing viticulture, fruit culture, and oenology.
And in those days, Alan Hickenbotham was purely the chemistry, was he?
Yes, that's right. Alan Hickenbotham joined the college in October 1929, in my first year.
Yeah. What winemaking facilities were there in those days at the college, right?
Well, we had the Bagshaw, Hallward Bagshaw Crusher, which is a very good little crusher, but very subject to blocking if you're fed too much at once. But okay, it was a simple crusher, and then we had five or six fermenting tanks, which would take a few tons of grapes, open fermenters. We had underground tanks, and we had a basket press, and of course the pumps were hand pumps, plus all the odds and ends that you need to do the winemaking.
And was the concentration on fortified wine production?
We did both. We did mostly dry red wine. And then Sam Wynne came into the scene. And see, this was Depression time, and the government costing against Roseworthy was restricted. And Roseworthy used to run on deficit finance in those days. Mm. And Roseworthy, if the college would have spent so much money, and all right, the government would make that up in due course. And I believe there was a hue and cry from the politicians because Roseworthy cost them £8,000. So that time. So the money was restricted. Now, we had a crop and we had to do something with the wine. Sam Wynne of Melbourne, and he came into the picture. He supplied spirit to fortify the wine to port. Mm-hmm. and he provided the hogsheads to transport it. And so we'd make the wine and fill the hogsheads and off to Sam Wynne. And that gave us a bit of a fillip.
Now, Sam Wynne had a share in winemaking facilities at McGill too, I think, at the time.
Yes.
With Hertel Walker.
That's right. Yes, that's correct. Yes.
So he would have had a strong South Australian connection.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, Ray, do you recall how large the vineyard was at Roseworthy?
I can't recall exactly what that was. I would have thought about 40 acres or something like that.
And varieties?
Yes. We had Shiraz and Cabernet Sauvignon that I can think of. But I can't recall what the other varieties were, but I know that we had a range of varieties, like a few vines of various varieties. Mm. I can even remember Dorodillo being there.
You wouldn't have been alone having Dorodillo in the vineyard, would you?
No, Dorodillo. There was some Muscat as well.
Now, the Dorodillo was a grape that was planted along the river, wasn't it, irrigated?
For spirit, yes. I remember we had some Malbec, yes.
Now, Ray, did you visit other wineries as part of the course?
We did very little of that. We did more in the area of dairying, visiting the dairying factories than wineries. I'm trying to think of visiting wineries. I don't recall that.
Well, I wonder, could we digress from the wine for a minute, Ray, which we'll come back to. Talk about the dairy side, because you became very interested in dairy technology.
Yes, that's right. And coming from Murray Bridge, with the strong dairying influence from the irrigated, reclaimed swamp areas. And my father at the hardware store was very much involved with the dairy farmers and also the belly farmers, but he was strongly in support of agriculture. Wait a minute, I've just lost my train of thought there. Dairy technology, that's right. And at high school, with leaving honours geography, we had to do some economic history and economics of the area. Well, of course, dairying and dairy technology at the Farmers Union and Ems Gold factories, that was an important part. We lived next door to the foreman of the Farmers Union factory, and I had just about carte blanche entry there, and I used to roam around in that factory. I knew that factory inside and out. So that was before going to Roseworthy. So then what appealed to me was the Morfitt Prize in dairying. And of course the Morfitts were very much involved at Woods Point, just south of Murray, downstream from Murray Bridge. So, all right, well, the dairying was interesting, so I gained the Morfitt Prize in first year, and the Morfitt Prize in year two, and again in year three. And that included, if you please, a gold medal. But nevertheless, I enjoyed that work.
Do you still have the gold medal, Ray?
Oh, yes, yes. So that there was an accent on dairy technology, and Dolph Baker was very supportive there as a lecturer, and visits to milk factories, that all encouraged that thought.
Do you recall any of those visits to the factories at all?
Well, in particular to in Gawler, the butter factory, What's the name of it?
No, I'm struggling.
I can't think, but a butter factory in Gawler was one, and of course the Murray Bridge factory for another. Yes, so they were good.
So there was a strong practical accent on each side of the course.
Yes, that's right, yes. And of course at Roseworthy we did butter making and cheese making, and we went through most of the motions. But in a simple farm setting. I like the technology of it, and the particularly with the cheese making and with all the bacterial work involved in that. There's quite a bit there to interest one.
I was going to say, Ray, the scientific side seems to suit your character to the ground.
Yes, that's right. That's what I preferred.
Now, Ray, you said when you completed your course successfully, it was a very difficult time in the Great Depression.
Yes.
Your father took you to Waite Institute.
Yes.
What did you do to try and find a job in the short term? How did you approach that?
Well, I was on the lookout for any opportunities and to be useful. As I mentioned, I kept ledgers for my father. That enabled me to do a little bit of fishing occasionally. And of course, there was the main social event at Murray Bridge, the Hunt Club Ball. I got involved with that and involved in some of the local things. And then, of course, in July, the offer to go with School of Mines to Plumbago Station. So
was that for wool classing, was it?
That was wool classing, yes, student wool classing.
Had you been doing a course there?
Oh, well, we'd done that at Roseworthy.
Oh, I see.
And this was School of Mines. Yeah. And here we are, right in the practical field. And as I mentioned, 30,000 sheep in 6 weeks. Mm. That's about 1,000 a day. Mm. Of course,
Was it a 12-stand shed?
Eight stands, yes.
That's a lot of sheep going through.
Yes. And I distinguished myself, of course, as you know, with manning the tables. You have to wait at the start of each run until some fleeces come on. Well, one of the shearers had a poisoned foot, and his stand was vacant. So what did I do? I didn't ask anybody. I just went up, grabbed a sheep, and shore it. And the wool classer said, "Well, that's okay, Ray, but don't do it again." He said, "You'll upset the union rep." So
the whole shed will go out.
So that was that. Yes.
So that was 1932, Ray. You were involved with that.
Yes.
And eventually you're searched out from Adelaide and brought back. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, yes.
And you come back into the you come back to your cadetship.
Yes, that's it.
Now, could we just go into some more detail about the cadetship and what that involved for you back at Roseworthy?
Well, to start with, that was November 1932, and I went into the winery with John Williams. That involved handling the wine, racking and cellar operations. So that was getting onto the practical side. And also viticulture, doing some vine breeding, with crossing varieties. That was interesting, but of course, that's a long range thing, and of course I wasn't there long. But it was interesting to do some of this crossing of varieties, and seeing the grapes develop from that. But of course, it didn't come to anything simply because I left after a short time. And then, of course, all the winery operations. And then that was followed on with the session with Alan Higginbottom.
Yes, which proved to be very successful.
Yes, that's right. That gave me the leg on.
And that brought you to the attention of Leslie Penfold Highland.
That's right.
And Ray, when you went to Penfolds, in one sense, you came into contact with the university again on many occasions after that.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yes. I started... Leslie Penfold Harlett asked me, when would I be ready to start? And I said, well, OK, I'm ready on the 13th of December, 1934. And he wrote me a letter and said, oh, don't worry about that. Here's a cheque for £5 and start on the 2nd of January, 1935. So that was away. Now,
was £5 a significant sum?
Oh, yes. £5. I started with Penfolds at £4.10 until the first vintage, and then I went to £5 a week. And that was all right. Yeah,
just to have the work, Ray, was it? Too?
Oh yes, and £5 we were quite comfortable on that, and we saved up some money, and in 1939 we bought our first car for about £230.
So you were married to Coral by this time?
Oh, yes, yes. We were married in at the end of 36. Yeah. I went in 1936, in September, I went to the university with Professor Killen Macbeth and also Dr. Pennycook. Mm-hmm. C.W. Pennycook. And...
C.W., was it?
C.W., yes. C. Pennycook, C-U-I-C-K. Mm. And they were good to me. They introduced me to the Cambridge pH meter, how to get along with it, Professor Macbeth offered me the use of his private laboratory. Mm. So I worked there
But could you tell us what you worked on, Ray? Because this is particularly interesting, both in the university allowing you to do it, but also it played a big part in one of your contributions to the wine industry.
Yes, that's right. Well, we have to go back a step, and that the mid-30s, were plagued with sweet wine disease in the wineries. And to say that that would go through a winery like a bushfire is perhaps being over dramatic. But the winemakers didn't know when this would pop up, and it would be wine in hogsheads, which is most inconvenient, because you can't do anything with it in hogsheads. Of course, you have to pump it out and deal with the wine. Well, of course, there's all this wine spoilage going on, and nobody knew what to do with it. So there was all sorts of theories of what it was, and the French literature was no help to us. So I worked along the lines that I thought pH might be involved with this, having been interested in pH under Alan Higginbotham. Mm. So, all right. So I went to the university and took my wine. And don't forget, transport was by train.
Oh, yes, of
course. And walking from the station to the university. And I could only carry a certain amount. I often wondered why I didn't carry wine for presentation, but of course I couldn't carry it. So anyway, that's by the way. I wanted to find the effect of various acids on the pH of wine. So I used tartaric acid and citric acid and sulfuric, I think it was. I used a range of acids. Showing the effect on pH. So that meant measured additions and then recording the pH. And of course this was great sort of data for a graph. Mm-hmm. So I graphed all the results. And as I mentioned earlier, at the university, some of the graphs finished up on dotted lines because I'd run out of sample. The professor had drank my samples.
This is Professor Macbeth.
Yes.
He drank your samples.
So there we go. And now that gave me a bit of understanding on pH. But it still didn't solve the problem of...
Did you write a paper up on that, Ray?
Only internal, mm-hmm. because that was the time you didn't discuss what you were doing to other winemakers. Mm. But I sent a copy to Professor Macbeth as a courtesy, mm. describing it. That I remember that was a full scap, a typed full scap, and there was a couple of lines on the next page. And that stated pH, along the lines of pH might be a useful tool in the control of bacteria in wine.
Mm.
Now, that was a sort of a throwaway line, but that was the key to the whole thing. So that was, we've got a little more understanding. Now, we'll project forward a little. The wine industry, of course, is very worried about this sweet wine disease because it was occurring in the wines that had been sent to London.
Yes, and it caused a significant monetary loss.
That's right. Mm. Big problems. So the wine board appointed John Fornishan to do some research. Well, he determined that it was lactobacillus. And he also subjected the growth of the bacteria to a condition, varying conditions with acids, pH, tannin, alcohol, temperature, all these variables. He subjected the bacteria to those conditions. And he issued a preliminary report. And that was a Ronio report, I remember, the old Ronio method of duplication. And prior to going home to Murray Bridge for a weekend, I'd popped that report into my pocket. Well, the Melbourne Express was crowded. My new wife, she found a seat. I couldn't, so I sat at the end of the carriage, under a dim light, I sat on the suitcase. Well, that wasn't very exciting with the clackety clack of the rails. No, I pulled this report out and read this, went under that dim light, and the penny dropped. I thought, gee, I can use this. And being interested in pH, I couldn't get back to work quick enough. So I got some information. And Leslie Penfold Highland appeared on his usual Monday morning visit. And I broached this subject and told him what I'd done. And he said, well, you'd better get some information. And I said, well, I've done that, Mr. Highland. And I held up three brochures. He said, which is the best? And I said, this one, the Cambridge. Well, he said, get it. Now, that gives you some idea of perhaps the feeling about the problem of this sweet wine disease, because it was a real...
Wasn't that worth about £1,000, Ray? Was that right, or was that...
No, that was £100.
£100?
£100.
But that's a lot of money.
That was 20 weeks of my
exactly.
income. So, as I say, he didn't even ask how much it cost. Get it. But you can see he was so embroiled in this problem that this looked as though it might be useful. So I got it. And from Faldings, they were very helpful. Well, all right, here's the new equipment. Now what are you going to do with it? What standards are you going to adopt? So... I was flying blind at this stage, but I had Fordishan's raw data, and I interpreted from that and worked out my standards, and I'd say, well, pH being a negative factor, it must be not more than pH 3.8, and that was the standard. And to achieve that, if a wine was more than pH 3.8, I used tartaric acid to bring it down to that level. So that was the start of the control of the lactobacillus in wine. Now, I've been through almost 39 years with Penfolds, and I haven't lost a litre of wine through bacterial action. And because it was attention to detail, but I'm not the only one in it, I had a good staff.
Mm.
And they had their standard, and they stuck to it through thick and thin.
But Ray, this was a huge step forward for Penfolds, wasn't it?
Oh yes, and of course you don't tell anybody else. You don't tell the others what happened. Of course, John Williams knew, and Hick, they knew about it.
Mm.
And of course, these things, they filter out. And of course, with what John Fornishan had done, well, the industry finally cottoned onto that. But I'd cottoned on ahead of them.
Yeah, it's interesting with Hick and John Williams. Hick goes on to become basically the state chemist, didn't he?
Yes, that's right.
And John went down to Coonawarra with Wins. Didn't he become their chief viticulturist?
Yes, at Modbury.
At Modbury.
Yeah, he used to travel to Coonawarra.
Mm.
And he used to tell, his boss. Why can't I think of that? He used to tell him, David Wynne, look, David, if you don't slow down from 90 miles an hour, I'm going to get out and walk.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, Ray, I just realised that I've neglected to ask you something about the college life itself that we discussed earlier.
Yes.
And that was your part in the exhibition of
31. Well, 31. Yes, that's right.
So I apologise.
That's a separate chapter. If we can, can you put that on the pause for a moment, please? Yes. Well, this was quite an adventure. The college had entered an exhibit in the 1931 exhibition at the exhibition building on the corner of North Terrace and Frome Road. But the college truck was too small to take the museum cases, the glass-topped cases, with the exhibit. So John Kilgour and I were given the task of taking the exhibit to Adelaide on a hay wagon with four Clydesdales. So in due course, the wagon was loaded up, ready for an early start the next morning. It was winter time. We started off in the dark with our four horses, and we were about Roseworthy by the time the sun came up, so we were well on the way. We went through Gawler, of course, and the usual track, and nearing Smithfield, one of our horses, Hawick, H-A-W-I-C-K, I remember his name, Hoik, went down in the shafts. Well, we managed to get off to just get clear of the road, and here was a horse down. Now what do you do? Well, fortunately, our veterinary officer, Bill Bennett, was following on behind. So he diagnosed the problem as windy colic. And he said, Ray, go over to that farmhouse and ask the woman if she's got a pound of bicarb soda, which I did. She had the bicarbonate of soda and let me have it. So I took this back to Bill. He opened the horse's mouth, and with handfuls of bicarb, he shot that over his tongue, and in no time the horse was got onto his feet again. Well, now, being a shafter, and you and you're travelling on the board behind the horse, you're close up to him. And Bill said, well, he might be blowing off a bit on the journey. Well, we didn't fancy that very much, so we decided to tow him and put one of the leaders in the shaft, and off we went. And, of course, that took us through what is now Elizabeth, but that was farmland. It was wheat crops, hay crops, and just the occasional house. So we moved along at a very leisurely pace, as you may guess, and it was the sun came out. I can remember how we could how I could lay back on the feed bags, and John would drive and we'd take turns. Eventually we arrived at Frome Road, and now we had to get into the exhibition building. So the gateway...
Ray, should we explain that the exhibition building was situated next to what is now Bonython Hall?
Yes, that's right.
Approximately where the law school is.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yes, that's it. Yes, that's the one. School of Mines, as it was.
Yes.
And the gateway, these big wrought iron gates, the gateway was just a little wider than the hay wagon. Of course, it's a full-size hay wagon. So John Kilgour took the leaders off, and I was able to edge the horses and the wagon through this gateway, and we unloaded and okay. That job's done. Now it was the Jubilee Oval in those days. Adjoining that was some stables, so that's where we left our horses. John went to his home. And I went to a cousin's place at Westbourne Park, and that was that. The next morning, we harnessed up, and off we go to Glenunga. There we picked up a piano. And for the life of me, I can't recall how we got that piano up on a hay wagon, but we did. And then we moved back into the city and found ourselves at the south end of King William Street. In those days, of course, no traffic lights. It was point duty policemen. And we just mooched along gently. The tram cars would come behind. You'd hear ding, ding, ding. And they were very patient. Nobody abused us. We'd have to wait until we could pull over to let the tram through. The point duty policemen were helpful. So that took us right through King William Street as far as Hindley Street. So we turned into Hindley Street, and then again John took the two leaders, and I went down Hindley Street until I could find a place to turn round with just the shafters. I returned, and we pulled up against Smith's Furnishers, and we loaded some chairs on there. Okay, off we go again into King William Street, down to North Terrace, and we're pulling around. I was driving and pulling around the point duty policeman, who nearly ran over his toes, but he didn't mind. And of all things, on that busy intersection, down went a pair of shafts. The back chain had let go. So what do you do? There's no other thing. You have to get out and lift the shafts and attach the back chain. So we did that. Back to Frome Road and out of the city with our load. We got as far as Little Para. That was our object because they had stables.
Yeah.
So we booked in there, fixed up our horses and booked in there. Well, not satisfied just to sleep there, we thumbed our way back to the city by car. We went to West Theatre and saw a World War I war film. And then we joined the last train to Gawler. We got out at Salisbury, and it was a moonlit night, and we tracked across the paddocks to Little Para and went to bed. So we were gluttons for punishment, I think.
Now, Ray, what What did the Roseworthy College display consist of for the exhibition? Can you recall that?
There was some wheat variety exhibits, and there were some dairying exhibits on the composition of cheese. Mm. And there are some of the exhibits. I can't recall any more of them. But there it was. So the next day, the third day, it was an easy day just from Little Parra to Roseworthy. So that was that. Now, in due course, we had to go back and get the exhibit. So we did that with having the experience of the first time. We made our way from Roseworthy to the exhibition building on day one and loaded up and returned day two. But it was a heavy day. The horses were very tired, giving them such a big haul. I can remember coming out of Williston and it was dark, and we just let them take their own pace. And arriving back at Roseworthy, well, we handed over to other students to take the horses out because we were tired too.
Yes.
It was they were big days. But that, looking back, that was a bit of history, isn't it? You won't see that again.
No. No, well, you certainly won't see those sun-drenched harvest fields where Elizabeth is.
That's right, yeah. Yes. There it was. Yes, just open country then. Mm. Yeah.
Now, Ray, just coming back again to the wine link-up with Roseworthy, your initial link-up, with the university as well, was you had the link-up with John Fornichon that had begun.
Yes.
And John becomes the first head of the Australian Wine Research
That's
Institute,
right. Yes.
Which is based at the Waite Institute.
Yes, yes.
And you had an ongoing relationship with both John Fornichon and that institute, is that correct?
Yes, yes, and also with Bryce Radgan. He comes into the scene. He was an assistant to John Fornichon when he was at the Waite Institute.
And there's another person that comes into the scene, and that's Dr. McCartney.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right.
So it's quite a mix of people getting involved here, but this is some years on, of course, 15,
yes.
Probably 15 years on.
Yes.
Dr. J.E. McCartney was brought to South Australia, wasn't he?
Yes, but, yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes, wait a minute. Can you pause for a moment? Yes, thank you. He gave me that, you see.
Yeah. So, Ray, we're talking about Dr. McCartney, and you've brought out this volume, which is the 9th edition of the Handbook of Practical Bacteriology.
Yes.
And this played a big part in your work, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. If perhaps we could leave Dr. McCartney just a moment.
Yes.
And we're speaking of John Fornichon and Bryce Radgan. And then there were other people that helped me at the Waite Institute. Can you pause, please? But now we're right. Yes, I had great help from Dr. Clary Piper, Dr. C.T. Piper, concerning trace metal analysis. And this is the trace metals were an important factor in quality control in wine. Excess metals, of course, copper and iron particularly, caused great problems. So the object was to determine the iron and copper content of wines so that we knew what we could do with quality control. So Dr. Piper helped me with the wet chemistry of determining these things. That involved quite an extensive process, purifying chemicals to start with, including sulfuric acid, which is very hard to distill, we found out. With doing those Those jobs, it took me 2 days to do an essay, and so that was not fast enough. So I modified the procedures to a micro method, and we could get a result in a half a day. So that was an improvement, but still too slow. Well, can you pause, please, a minute? I'm just. Yes, now we'd got to the half a day. Yes. Now, I was still looking for a method to give us a result in short time. So I looked at emission photometry, square wave pyrography, and they didn't meet the bill, because we wanted copper and iron and lead, and you might wonder why we needed a lead assay.
I was going to ask you.
Yes. Now, the reason for that was that some of our overseas customers were very strict on lead content. Now, the people of Malay, as it was then, they had big problems with lead because of the activities of their population. The Chinese women used a face powder which contained lead. The workers at the tin mines handling the ingots, had a lead impurity, so they had lead on their hands, and not being very fussy about eating, they would eat without washing their hands, so there were lead problems.
Mm.
Lead capsules were a bit of a problem to them. So, realising that we had to give them assurance that our wines would comply with their requirements of point half of a half a part per million, or 0.5 milligrams per litre, we had to give them an assurance. And I thought, well, if our people give that assurance, I have to see that our wines meet that standard. So that hence the search. Well, then atomic absorption spectrophotometry, as it was called then, came under notice. And I went to CSIRO at Fisherman's Bend and met Dr. John Willis, again taking samples with me.
Did he knock them off as well?
No, I cope with them. Now, methods for atomic absorption spectrometry, as it's called now, the methods for atomic absorption were developed by Alan Walsh, Dr. Alan Walsh, later becoming Sir Alan. He was overseas at the time, so John Willis took me in hand, and we analysed wines for metal content, and it appeared on that trial it would suit our work nicely. This was very new to the whole industry, that industry as a whole, which included mining, of course. So it was determined to procure a unit, but then you could not just put an order in for an atomic absorption outfit and get it. There was nothing available, so we had to buy all the components from London, United States, Melbourne, all over the place. We had to buy the components and put them together ourselves. That was quite a search, but it worked out all right. The heart of the machine, the monochromator, had to come from East Germany, and this is the time of the Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
We despaired. We wondered whether we'd ever get it out of East Germany, but we did. It arrived in Sydney, and we were told it would come overland to Adelaide next week. Well, on the journey, the truck was stolen, and we thought, oh, we won't get our monochromator. You can't sell it. The thieves wouldn't be able to sell a monochromator in the pub. Maybe they'll throw it over a bridge somewhere and get rid of it. But anyway, it the police recovered the vehicle and the contents, so we got our monochromator. Then we had to put all this gear together, and John Willis said, well, I'll come over and help you get started. So, all right, we got things ready. John Willis rang and said, I'm sorry, Ray, I can't come. But he said, set the unit going, start everything at zero and build it up from there. He said, it won't blow up. So we did just that, and we got the thing into commission. And that gave us a result from 2 days to start with, reducing to half a day, and we got a result in 2 minutes. So that was wonderful.
And this built on the work you'd done with Clary Piper, or he'd done with you.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, Clary Piper, and then over to Fisherman's Bend.
Yeah.
That's right.
And Ray, then coming back to Dr. McCartney and the AWRI, perhaps if you could just talk about that link as well.
Yes, that's right. Now, I first met Dr. McCartney at a lecture on phase contrast microscopy at the one of the lecture rooms at the Institute of Medical and Veterinary Science, the IMVS. I spoke to him, and he invited me to contact him at a later date, which I did. The phase contrast microscopy enabled one to observe bacteria as though they were stained. It's what should we say, an optical factor, an interference factor that shows the image quite distinctly. Whereas with ordinary with the ordinary light, can you shut that down, please?
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So Ray, you were talking about the refractive index.
Yes, the refractive index of the wine and the substrate is almost the same, so it's difficult to see without staining. Phase contrast introduces a new conception of being able to see without staining, which is a plus. Mm. The can I mention the phase contrast, how it eventuated?
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yes, Dr. McCartney has described to me how the phase contrast came about just prior and during the World War II. The Zeiss company in Germany were experimenting with phase contrast, and they had produced a model that demonstrated this, and they had patented it. After the war, as war reparation, those patents did not apply to Britain. So the Vickers company took over those patents and made up their own phase contrast microscope, the Cook, Troughton and Sims. Troughton, T-R-O-U-G-H-T-O-N. And now, Dr. McCartney had one of these microscopes, And he lent it to me to evaluate it, and I could see the possibility of it being very useful. So I returned that to him, and procured an Italian unit, which was very good, and I used that quite effectively. Then Don Ditter wanted a microscope in Sydney, so I sent that one over to him. Now I had to get another phase contrast microscope. In the meantime, the lights company, LEITZ, the lights company had developed their own system. It meant that if they wanted to use the phase plate that Zeiss had developed, they would have to pay their competitor a royalty. So they produced their own version of phase contrast in the nature of a special condenser, a variable condenser, which was mounted under the stage, and which was quite versatile, in fact an improvement on the original. So I had this new lights equipment, which was top, which was extremely good. And I used that and found some rather interesting features. In the 1950s, I noted that the acetic bacteria were surviving in filtered wine, and I was able to determine that because, following Dr. McCartney's advice, I had procured a first-class MSE centrifuge, which enabled me to swing down 250ml bottles of wine, pour off the top layer, take the little bit into a smaller tube, and swing again. I worked on that and found the acetic bacteria was surviving quite well in the body of the wine, which in my book made it a facultative anaerobe by definition. We usually think of it as an aerobe. Anyway, that's by the way. And I thought, well, okay, that's interesting. You just put that at the back of your head and it's there. In the mid-1980s, some researchers in California at Davis University, they discovered exactly the same thing, which is rather neat. And they published that in the American Society of Oenology journal.
Mm. So, Ray, what intrigues me is that from your first student days right through your working life, there was a continuum with the University of Adelaide.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that is so.
And not necessarily of anyone's making, it's just where the expertise was at the time.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's how it worked out, yes.
And so, in a sense, the university had a part in the history of Australian winemaking.
Yes, that is so. Mm. Yes, that's right, yes.
And Ray, I just was reflecting that I recall you once saying that even, I think it was in the 1940s, you actually gave a talk to the South Australian Chemical Institute?
Yes, that's right.
At the university?
Yes, that's right. And at the Lady Simon Hall?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, was it, that topic was the chemistry as an aid to winemaking?
That is right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 1950. And Bryce Rankin was there, a young Bryce Rankin. Mm-hmm. And over all those years, I could take paragraphs out of that talk and substitute that in a talk today. The whole paragraph. You take the paragraph.
So nothing's changed, essentially.
Nothing's changed. Damn. That's right.
Perhaps the superficialities of equipment may have, but the essence hasn't.
Yes, that's right. Yes. When I spoke for that honorary doctorate, I mentioned that I'd done that in 1950, but with the stricter of time, I had to cut out some of the nice little bits. And I could have. But what I would have said there is that in 1950, Bryce Rankin was in the audience, and I guess he would recall that. And I could take all these paragraphs and substitute them today. But Bryce Rankin is here. He's here with us today. But I had to miss. I had to leave that little bit out.
Yeah. I was going to come to that too, Ray. That you received the honorary doctorate from the university very recently.
That's right.
What did that mean to you that occurred?
Well, it was mind blowing. I nearly fell off my chair when I read that letter of I was acquainted of that. Yes.
Mm. Well, Ray, I'd just like to thank you for being willing to talk today about your memories.
Yeah, but thank you very much. Look, if anything of interest here, I mentioned the American Society of Enology and Viticulture. The work I did in 1936 at the Adelaide University was replicated in the mid-1980s and published, but with much more sophisticated approach. Mm. But that was rather amusing to see.
Absolutely.
See these things come up.
50 years on.
Yes, that's right.
Well, thank you very much, Ray.
Oh, yes, good.